We're joined by Anthony. I'm going to ask you to say
Giacchino.
Your last name.
Yeah.
Okay.
Giacchino.
I don't want to butcher it embarrassingly. Again, documentary filmmaker. He's been working on a movie on the Camden 28. And we're also joined by a member of the Camden 28 as well, John Swinglish. Let me just make sure he can hear us. Are you there, John?
I can hear you. I want to talk to you about that selection of music. You call that music? Ooh, I'm telling you.
I did provide a disclaimer. I did
yes,
warn you.
Yes, you did. Yes, you did.
All right, let's talk. We were talking about the trial and, I guess, defense strategies. We were talking about how some members of the Camden 28 chose to defend themselves, others with co-counsel. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the people who testified at the trial. Is there anyone in particular that's particularly memorable that you might be able to share?
We chose to go in there and tell the truth. And a lot of us did our own opening statement since we're doing a pro se defense. And I remember my own opening statement. I stood there. I spoke for maybe 10, 15 minutes, maybe not even that long, 10 minutes. And in the midst of that, said, look, I did it. I'm glad I did it. And if given the opportunity, I would do it again. This is speaking to the jury. And other people said similar things. We chose to put the war on trial, put the FBI on trial, but pretty much a system that is going on and creating these situations on trial. And not say, oh, we didn't do it, or we're sorry we did it, or any of that sort of thing. None of that. We did it. This is why we did it. You know, you're talking about Mick Doyle earlier, and he's really tuned into the plight of Camden. And during the trial, for instance, he showed slides of sections of Camden, New Jersey, and bombed out areas of Vietnam without comment, and the jury could not tell which was which. That's the kind of stuff we did during that trial.
And, John, I also want to say it's I don't want to give the listeners the impression that, you know, you knew you guys were going to come out of this with the not guilty.
Oh, no, right. Not at all. No, we were sure we were going for some time, not 47 years. Nobody's going to send us up for 47 years. And this judge was not going to, as we got to know him better and better. But I had drinks with him after the trial, and we talked about all this. And I asked him at one point, you know, what would you have done if we were convicted? And he kind of ran it down. But for some people, he called it a stinger. He would have given them a stinger. Others he would have sent up for a little longer because he thought they were the real ringleaders. You know, right or wrong, I mean, the guy's a federal judge. That's the way he's going to view it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we weren't going to go for 47 years, but we would have done some time, definitely, yeah.
I understand one of the Berrigan brothers also testified at the trial. Can you talk about both of them? Okay. Can you talk about what sort of things they said on the stand?
Yeah, I called Phil Berrigan, and I can't remember who called Dan. And you also mentioned Howard Zinn earlier, the historian. He was also called. Phil and I talked about in a question and answer format, of course. You know, where he started, how he got into it, and he had been a Josephite priest that ministers mostly to the black community, and he had been in Baltimore at St. Peter Claver Church, and, you know, what he saw and how he saw the war affecting the people who live in the city, who are stuck in the cities, and billions of dollars, you know, going into this war while other things are just left to die, left to fall apart, and not just buildings and playgrounds, but people's lives, and how that affected him. And he was also involved in the civil rights movement early on. And then, of course, when the war came along, he needed to take another stand. He needed to go in a different direction. And that's when he began to, you know, formulate some ideas and did the Baltimore action in October of 67. And he also talked about prison and what he did in prison. And in fact, at one time I asked him what he does in prison, because he'd been in and out all the time. And he says, mostly you just do time. You just do time. That's it. You're just waiting to get out. You know, you do what you can while you're in there. He was writing. I think he published a book or two while he was in. But he talked a lot about what got him to that point. See, part of what we were doing in the trial is talking about what got us to that point. And a lot of other judges in other trials would not allow the defendants to do that. the Clarkson Fisher allowed us to do that. What brought you to that point on the 22nd of August in 1971? How did you get there? And we were allowed to talk about that. And Phil Berrigan being part of my story, I called Phil Berrigan.
And I would even say where Howard Zinn comes in as a witness, and you should ask him about this next week. I mean, he was shocked himself that he was actually allowed to talk about the history of civil disobedience.
Yes.
You know, the history of the Pentagon Papers, where in previous trials that he had been called as a witness to, the judge would say, well, that has nothing to do with did they break into the building or not. You know, it was always, the previous trials were always, did they do it or did they not do it? And that was sort of, you know, that was the avenue down which they were only allowed to talk, you know, and to explore the trial. But this judge, you know, basically, I guess the attitude was, well, they said they did it, so, you know, let's hear why they did it.
Yeah, exactly. And Howard tells a story, and I can just paraphrase. Anthony, you probably remember the words better than I do. About one judge.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, tell that story.
Well, he was, I think it was Milwaukee. You can ask him, but
yeah.
I think it was the Milwaukee 14, and he went there, and he was talking about the, you know, about civil disobedience, and when, you know, and he said, and then when he got to Thoreau, you know, started to talk about Thoreau, the judge stopped him and say, well, wait a minute, you can't talk about Thoreau because that's getting to the heart of the matter, and he basically didn't allow him, but I mean, you know. To tell him you're getting to the heart of the matter, you can't talk about that. Well, he certainly got to the heart of the matter in the Camden trial.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say so, John?
Yeah, yeah. Judge Fisher was great that way. Yeah, he really allowed us. I mean, that's why part of why it was a 3.5-month trial.
And
he really
like,
allowed us to tell our stories.
Something that really distinguishes this trial from the prior ones, in addition to the outcome itself, which I guess I will read and then ask a question that will pull us back just slightly, but I'm just going to read the first three paragraphs of the New York Times article that was written on the, I think, day after the verdict was read. A jury of 5 men and 7 women today found 17 members of the Camden 28 not guilty of breaking into the federal building here in 1971 and destroying draft files, even though the defendants admitted having done so, and 80 Federal Bureau of Investigation agents caught them at it. The verdict was the first total legal victory for the anti-war movement in 5 years of such draft record incidents. As James Lomax, the jury foreman, announced the verdict, the defendants and 200 supporters jamming the courtroom burst into cheers, wept, hugged one another, and sang a chorus of the hymn, Amazing Grace. I wanted to ask you, the jury I have a number of questions I want to ask. The jury instructions, though, they were instructed that they could not base a verdict, I believe, on any political sympathy with civil disobedience, even if they felt it. They were, and Anthony can probably articulate this far better than I can, they were, however, allowed, and I think this is the justification that they did use for their verdict, they were allowed to acquit if they felt that the crime could not have occurred without such considerable FBI intervention.
That's right. I think the words were, if the jury found that the government went to, it's the word wasn't outrageous, but like you know overreaching.
They call it overreaching governmental participation.
That's right, overreaching government participation. Then they could acquit. So you know, I mean, he allowed them that opportunity. You know that room to say, you know, and this may get into the questions. Well, was that the reason why the jury?
Yeah.
Said not guilty, and for some of them, yes, it was. For some of them, it was no. We agree with what they with what they did, and I think it was Anna Bertino told Father Doyle afterwards that she, you know, when they were sequestered, that she basically said, you know, you can talk till you're blue in the face, but they're not guilty, you know. So some of them were. Were certainly on the side of the defendants. And, I mean, in fact, all of them felt sympathy for the defendants because of the way that the judge allowed them to present themselves in the courtroom. But that didn't necessarily mean that they were going to say not guilty.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
So I think some of them needed, even though they agreed with the defendants, some of them needed a little.
We call it a legal hat rack.
That's right. That's
they
right.
needed that legal hat rack.
They needed
I
that.
Guess maybe half of them needed that. The other half were so fed up with the war by that point. I mean, Nixon's White House was falling apart. You know, this is another 2 years, almost a year and a half after what I was describing earlier, with that war being the major issue in our lives, day in and day out. I think half of them would have acquitted us on the first day.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Plus, like Anthony said, you know, with the pro se defense, they were allowed to see the human side of us. And we haven't been talking much about this, but there was a lot of humor in that courtroom. There was a lot, because we're a bunch of cut-ups. And we're a bunch of young, you know, somewhat anarchistic social activists, you know, with long hair and, you know, the whole thing. And we were not serious, serious people.
That's right. I mean, even the fact that the judge didn't even require you to stand when he walked in. Like, you didn't stand when he walked
That's
in,
right.
for example.
Yeah.
Little things like that. If it was somebody's birthday, they would, you know, sort of make a motion to, I'd like to enter in the record that, you know, today is Joni Riley's 22nd birthday. And, mm-hmm. you know, and the judge would be like, well, we all wish her a happy birthday. And,
yeah.
of course,
yeah.
that would always come from objections.
Right.
You know. From the prosecutors.
John would object, John Berry would object, and the judge would say, well, Mr. Berry, it's been said, so let's just get on with it, you know.
Yeah.
And we would also mention the previous actions, you know, today is the 5th anniversary of such and such an action, you know, we commemorated, et cetera, et cetera. And then we kind of knew we had the jury in our hands, or we thought we did, when fairly late in the trial, just before things started one day, one of the jurors stood up and said, Your Honor, we would like to commemorate the 10th or whatever it was, wedding anniversary of juror number 11. And everybody laughed, and we said, ah, we got him.
Yeah.
We got him.
And wouldn't you say also that, Merlin, you asked about witnesses before.
Right.
And it was described to me by members of the KM28 that probably the most emotional moment was when the mother of one of the
yeah.
defendants.
Yeah, tell that story.
That's right. Her name is Betty Good, Bob Good. He was one of the KM28. He called her as a character witness to sort of, you know, talk about their family life and all of this. And I mean, I think that when her testimony was over, the courtroom must have been in tears.
She had lost a son in Vietnam.
That's right. She had lost a son in Vietnam. And I mean, John, you remember the words exactly? I mean, it was, you know, there's a story, and you'll probably see it in the film, and I won't go into that. But her point was, you know, she had a son who died in Vietnam, and now she has a son who might go to jail because he was protesting the war in Vietnam, and how she was proud of the son for protesting this war. And I think, John, wasn't there something? Hoover had died by then, but the
Well, a couple things.
Yeah.
See, she had tried to, and we ran into this a lot. We were kind of baffled by this phenomenon. That is that parents who had lost kids in that war were opposed to our anti-war activities.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would scratch my head in the earlier days and say, wait, this doesn't add up. And it dawned on us at some point, these people need to justify their son's death. They can't go to bed every night or go home and say, well, he died for nothing. So Betty was still holding on to the idea that, well, but he died for something. I support Bob, but I know that, what was his name, Jim? No, Jim was the other brother. I can't remember his name now. Died for something. And she sat in that courtroom, and she listened to Howard Zinn the day before talk about the history of the war, the history of protests, the Pentagon Papers, and that one line in the Pentagon Papers. Remember, these Pentagon Papers now were not written by us or by, what's his name that released him?
Ellsberg.
Dan Ellsberg. These were papers from the Pentagon that actually the Rand Corporation on the West Coast had. But these were written by the Pentagon. There's that one line in there that says, basically, we're in Vietnam for tin, rubber, oil. They have it, we want it. And that jumps out of the hundreds of pages of the Pentagon paper. And she broke down and cried while Howard Zinn was on the stand. And then she told that story the next day, and she said, until yesterday, I was still holding on to the hope that my son had died for something, for some reason. In the meantime, Hoover had died, and a fellow named L. Patrick Gray had taken over the FBI. And I don't remember all the details, except at some point, he destroyed some FBI files,
right.
And that got out into the media, and they exposed it on the front page of Newsweek magazine, the cover of Newsweek. And he admitted that he had destroyed these files. And Betty Good's sitting up there on the stand, and as this great line, she says, "And if L. Patrick Gray, the head of the FBI, can destroy files, why can't my son?" And it was just a powerful moment. You know, I mean, this kind of stuff happened every day in that trial. It was incredible.
Yeah, and I also want to add that that she came to the reunion that we had.
Yeah.
And recounted that testimony and told that story again. And I would even say it was sort of the most emotional moment of that that day on May 4th.
It really was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to talk about that reunion in just a second, but let me ask both of you, what was the prosecution's argument in this case? What were the exact counts, and you know, what sorts of arguments did they make to support them?
Well, I think that what I think is kind of funny is that in the opening statements, who gets the first opening statements, John? You guys did?
Or
did the prosecution?
Oh, as far as actual side prosecution first.
Okay, so so basically, the prosecution was like, "We're going to prove that they broke into this building, that they did this, you know, that they did, they destroyed traffic." And you guys got up and were like, "That's right, we did it. Everything that they're going to prove, yeah, it just is pointless because we're telling you right now that we did it. They don't have to prove anything, you know. We're telling you." But I mean, it was basically that. I mean, I think what they wanted to, since the informer had sort of turned sides and was supporting the defense now, what the prosecution needed to do was to somehow prove that they would have done it anyway, even if the informer... Well, I think you guys admitted that. Even if he wasn't there, we would have done it. But, you know, they had to say that they were... They you know, they had done previous draft or you know, they tried continuously to get the, you know, you to admit that you had been involved in previous... That you didn't really need the informer to do this because you had done previous ones.
We were not blaming him at all.
What's that?
We were not blaming the informant at all.
Oh, that's right. So they weren't saying that, you know, that, oh we weren't going to do this. But the fact is that the prosecution was trying to say that, well, they've done previous ones, so what would have really stopped them from doing this one if the informer wasn't involved? I mean, wouldn't you say that was pretty much it, John?
Yeah, they try to argue the law, and that we were predisposed. You have to show that you're predisposed. You know?
Yeah.
Let me ask you about public opinion and public image. I gather, you know, Anthony and I were looking at a sign that is right in front of us right now of seven words we cannot say on a broadcast, and he had mentioned that George Carlin had put on a benefit show for you guys. Can you talk about, and you know, in this article it says that many supporters packed the courtroom on the day the verdict was read. Can you talk about the, I guess, public campaign outside of the courtroom that developed around this case?
Well, we had something going on every night at a church hall, and we also had, like, at noon, since we went into Lent, for instance, at noon during Lent, maybe on Wednesdays and Fridays, I don't remember exactly what, we'd have a little religious service outside. And a lot of people who could not get into the courtroom to attend those things, they may have been going to work because they have to go to work. But on their lunch break, they would stop by outside the courthouse or at a little park. There was a church across the street. They had a little area, I guess, you know, a court... What
courtyard?
Do you call it, you know? What is it?
Like a courtyard?
Courtyard, I'm trying to think.
Yeah.
I was thinking courtroom, you know, that we could use and that type of thing. So, plus we were putting out a little newspaper called Viewpoints, and, you know, it was fairly well known, very well known in South Jersey what was going on. And I think people followed the case fairly closely in the newspapers. The writers were good. People may take a half a day off and go and sit in the courtroom. But I think people were intrigued by what was going on and what these folks, these defendants, were saying.
Yeah,
and I think it just drew a lot of people in.
And you know, you had to get. I mean, there was no guarantee that you were going to get into the courtroom, even just as a public, you know, person just coming in, because it was just packed all of the time. Right. I think maybe at one point they even had to, you know, hand out, you know, some kind of a ticket or something like that for the days for the trial.
Yeah, they may have done. And just jumping forth, you know, it wasn't mentioned earlier, but when we did that thing on May 4th last year, that courtroom was packed also.
That's right.
And they had a second room with closed circuit TV.
yeah.
filled with people. I didn't know that until late in the day. I didn't know there were more people watching somewhere else.
Yeah.
But go ahead. I just want to mention
Let me just ask a very quick technical question, I guess, to Anthony. The New York Times headline, and the New York Times, particularly today, is not always the first place to go to for accuracy. But assuming today, I don't know. I mean, maybe this headline is correct. Maybe it isn't. But I'm assuming it says the headline reads, 17 of Camden 28 found not guilty. Did the what happened to the remaining?
Okay, yeah, because basically what happened was only from the Camden 28, only 17 were put on trial, and they planned on putting the remaining on trial after they finished with this okay. with this case, because these were sort of like, can I say, the heavies, John?
Yeah, you know, the people they really wanted to get.
Yeah, the 17 were the people they really wanted to get. They just felt that 28 would be just too many people to try to have in a courtroom at once. You know, so they tried 17, but the 17, they always consider themselves the Camden 28. They always say the Camden 28, even though 17. And when the trial was over, they quietly dropped charges against the remaining, and that of course never went to trial.
What exactly was done at the meeting? Were there some reenactments? Or?
Yeah, no, it wasn't reenactments. Again, it was the U.S. District Court for the District of New Jersey Historical Society contacted us because they knew we were doing this film, and you know, said that they didn't know what they wanted to do, but they wanted to do something to preserve the history of this trial, and could we help them? And then we suggested, Dave and I said, well, you know, why don't we try to get them, you know, because we were always trying to think, how can we go and film inside this courtroom? You know, we wanted to film in there anyway, and it sort of just so happened. It was like, well, they came to us. So we suggested that we would get together the members of the Kim 28 who were able to come. We would contact FBI agents who were involved in the case, the prosecutors, some of the witnesses, the defense attorneys. And let's have them come together and basically talk about the trial in the courtroom, the actual courtroom where they were on trial. And, you know, to sort of tell the whole story. This wasn't – the purpose was not to go and tell the story from the Camden 28's point of view. It was also to get the FBI's point of view. It was to get the prosecutor's point of view.
And the informant was there too.
That's right, and the informant was there also. And I would say I would say that all those sides pretty much, you know, came out there. I mean, you know, some people had said afterwards, well, you kind of really sort of celebrating the Camden 28, but the fact is they won. Right, John?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it happened. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
you write it, you
yeah.
know, like it or not.
That's
you know,
right. The Camden 28 won. So, I mean, obviously, even at the May 4th event is what we always called it. You know, there was this sort of real, I mean, The last thing they did was sang Amazing Grace in that courtroom again, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was just a wonderful trial. I have to tell you, though, the night before the May 4th event, we sat down. John's laughing. We sat down, Dave and I, with the members of the Kim 28. They had sort of like a little gathering that night to kind of go over what we were going to talk about. And there was still some resistance from some of the members about, you know, I don't understand why, you know, the FBI is, you know, going to be speaking in the first part of this thing. You know, I mean, this is the story of the Camden 28. And it was really, it was rough. That meeting was very rough because I really felt that it was going to be a disaster the next day. I really did, because I just thought, you know, I mean, we had spent months, almost 3 months planning for this,
yeah.
you know, and I had come up with this outline, and I was trying to make it as balanced as possible, because remember, this wasn't, the Camden 28 wasn't putting it on, I wasn't, the Court Society was putting it on, it was for them, really,
right.
you know, so, but there were differences of opinion as to who should talk first, and who should do this, and I'm telling you, it was a very long and lonely ride home, those 25 minutes back to my parents' house, where I stayed that night, afterwards, because, I really just thought this is going to be just a disaster. They don't want to do it this way. But I don't know, John. I mean, disaster is not the word.
You have a much better sense of that than I did, because when Gene Dixon and I walked into that room.
That's right. I sort of asked you.
At the center there, and you asked each of us, you said, hey, you know, I'm going to need some support here before that little meeting.
That's right.
Started,
I need some backup.
I didn't really know what you're talking about. I thought, support? What do you need support for? We're all here to do this thing.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, it started to happen. And we kind of laughed among ourselves afterwards and said, you know, we haven't changed in 30 years. You know, I mean, we still argue with one another over every little thing.
And I have to say, John, is that even though that was a really tough meeting for me, because I was really being challenged about, you know, what was my real motive here, you know, in doing this, I really learned, I think, a lot from that. And I really feel that I had a sense of what those early meetings must have been like before you went into the courtroom.
Yeah, we worked out everything.
And exactly, how it was sort of a real sort of democracy in the sense that everybody was getting in and saying, well, no, I want to do it this way, and I want to do it this way. And and it just goes again to that point I think I said earlier, that this, you know, it wasn't a foregone conclusion that they were going to be acquitted.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of arguments that went on among the defendants.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately they stuck together.
Yeah.
And then and
came
out.
Well, that was a thing.
Yeah.
And we would have sometimes almost all night, or certainly well past midnight, talking about what we're going to do the next day, and is that the best thing, and should we call this witness instead, or should we drop somebody, or, you know.
Yeah.
You know, just every little thing that comes up.
But I would
and
say.
So we worked it out. We hammered it out, and we always came to an agreement. We always said consensus. We don't quit until we have consensus.
Yeah, and just to go back to the May 4th thing, so, you know, going home and think this is going to be a disaster, but the next day, I mean, it sort of just fell together, and, I mean, you know, it was fine with the FBI and the prosecutors and the attorneys and stuff, and I just couldn't imagine it going better than it did, and I don't know if you think that same...
It was an incredible day, and I almost didn't go also, Merlin, I mean, I'll be honest, you know.
Yeah.
Because Anthony, well, I visited him up in New York City, a month before, it was early April.
Yeah.
And saw an outline. And I didn't like the outline. I looked at it and said, this is a bunch of junk. I can't believe, et cetera, et cetera. And I called you from my cell phone on the road and said, hey, scratch me. I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
And that was really ticked. And then we talked some more. And you know, and Gene kind of talked to me and said, John, if you just sit in the courtroom and watch, at least show up, you know.
Yeah.
And that went from showing up to being a part of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're all people that have very, very strong feelings.
Yeah.
But we, you know, we eventually always work it out. It was an incredible day, absolutely incredible day. It really was.
Can you share some of the thoughts that, you know, were offered by both the prosecution, the defendants, some of the witnesses there that day, some particularly memorable ones?
Yeah, I'll say something quick, John, and then you can. But one of the things that I thought was really great was that one of the prosecutors, now the main prosecutor, John Barry, he died a few years ago, but his wife was there. She didn't speak, but, you know, but she came because she knew that this was an important trial for him.
Well, she is now a federal judge.
That's
there
right.
A lot of federal judges sitting in that courtroom.
Oh, yeah, there are a number of federal judges. Yeah.
The interest was really amazing.
Yeah. No, but one of the things, but what we did have a prosecutor who was, his name is David Hinden. He's on the telephone. From California, he couldn't come in.
Yeah.
But he's no longer a prosecutor. Are you having a?
No.
Okay. He's no longer a federal prosecutor, but he's a school teacher and a high school teacher, and he actually uses Howard Zinn's book in his class now. And I just thought that was really funny when he, you know, being one of the prosecutors, was asking Howard Zinn, you know, wow, you know, my kids are going to be so excited when I tell them that I was actually talking to you, you know, today, and to sort of see that change. And I'm not saying that wasn't representative, you know, of that side, but that was just a nice moment, I thought, a really nice moment that, you know, it doesn't mean that everybody is always the same. I also thought that the back and forth between the U.S. attorneys and Cookie Radoffi was pretty, you know, in terms of the question of, well, why did you wait? Why didn't you just arrest us as soon as we, you know? And they're like, well, you know, it wasn't our decision. It was, you know, you could see, basically what I'm saying is that the passions from that time, I don't think that anybody really lost them in terms of how they felt back then.
Yeah, right.
They pretty much felt the same, pretty much, except for this prosecutor. But, you know, the attorneys and, but I mean, you know, there was no bad feelings between anybody. but
no,
they
no,
still would have.
Even though the FBI agent, what was his name? Was
Terry Neist.
Terry Neist, you know, just as adamant today as he was 30 years ago.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, the informant was there, basically explained why he did what he did.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, he was just as adamant. Almost in a sense saying that, you know, they were responsible for actually killing people by stopping people from being drafted. I mean, in the sense that, well, then this unit's not going to have enough people and maybe they're not going to get replacements, you know?
Right.
So, you know, the feeling sort of ran from, I would say, you know, that they still felt the same. And like I said, the best example I thought so was that prosecutor.
Yeah. For me, it was such an incredible day because we had gotten together, as Anthony said, you know, the night before, and we really had a little reunion, you know, a little party with some, you know, finger food and stuff like that the night before. But just to be with these people, I missed that previous reunion because I'm a photographer and I had to work that weekend, so I couldn't go up there. So this was the first time I'd seen a lot of these people, except for a little, you know, here and there, a few folks, in 30 years. And it was powerful for me to walk into that room and see these people. And in some cases, actually try to guess who that is because we've all changed a bit. We've put on weight or we've lost hair or whatever, you know. And the gal's lost hair and the guy's put on weight. Isn't that the way it works?
Yeah. So,
but it was just, you know, incredible. And then to be in that courtroom and be standing together once again. And some questions came up, you know, how important was the affidavit? How important was the judge? And we disagreed openly on that, but that was okay. We had different opinions on the role Clark and Fisher played, or the role the affidavit and the informant played in our acquittal. But that was okay. But just to be there together. And there were a few things that were reenacted. Howard Zinn and Betty Good were the only two, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I wouldn't even call them reenactments, really. I mean, basically, we allowed them to take the witness stand again.
Well,
and,
that's true.
And to recount what they talked about.
What happened.
You know, what happened then. So Betty Good actually read a little piece of her testimony.
Right.
But a reenactment might not be the right word.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
Was it awkward for you guys to see the informant again?
Well, not for me. I don't know about others. Because, like I said, I had seen him right after we got out of jail, and I kind of stayed in touch with him. And he and I spent a little time in church after everybody else kind of withdrew. The night before his son's funeral, there was kind of a wake and service or whatever, or maybe the before the burial. Maybe we had a mass that night also. But he and I were pretty much the last to walk out, and we were talking on the way out. And I stayed in touch with him, and it was really iffy whether he would come at all.
That's right.
When I was up at Anthony's apartment in Manhattan, Anthony said, well, why don't you just call him? Just call him and see if he'll come, you know. So basically I picked up the phone and said, hey, you know, it's John. I'm up here at Anthony's, et cetera, et cetera. And we got to talking. We've always been on pretty good terms. I don't know why. And, in fact, he said it in the courtroom that day that one of the reasons he came is that,
that you
phoned him.
Yeah.
So it wasn't awkward for me. I'll bet you it was for some people who still carry a real hatred for him. Certainly Mike, for instance.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Gene. You know, Camden friends, people he knew. You know, there's a difference when a stranger who I never met until a week before the action turns us in affects me differently than a good friend who he's known for years would affect Mike Giacondo.
That's right. And I would even maybe say that the reason why he ended up coming, because originally he told me yes. And, okay, we'll be there. And then I got a, well, I don't know. And
oh, yeah,
then...
Right.
And then it was sort of like an I don't know, and then that's when you called him. And then the Philadelphia Inquirer, the day before the event, had a front-page article about what was going to happen the next day. And he was interviewed, and in the newspaper article, he said he's not going. That was the first time we all heard. Well, you know, so I was like, oh, you know. And, I mean, I really wanted him to be there for a couple of reasons. One was obviously because of... just for the accuracy of the thing. And when it was the same idea was that, well, if he's not here, then other people are going to talk for him. That's number one. Number two is, you know, obviously for the film, it would be nice to have him to have him there. And I think that – I don't know if he expected the reporter to have published that. But I think that once he read that, that it said, oh, he's not coming –
right.
You know, people probably were thinking, oh, he's either too scared to come or something like that. And I called him, and then he says, no, I'm going to be there. So, I mean, if you think about it, John, it just kind of is like, you know, flip flopping, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to go sort of reminiscent of back then.
Yeah.
From the